Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. If you ask a lot of 11-year-olds what they want to be when they grow up, you are likely to hear the answer, YouTuber, I want to be a YouTuber. But when they say that, the content they want to create is really more about funny fails and cat memes, not money. Except for Rishi Vamdutt. It is an amazing story. He's an 11-year-old creator of a YouTube channel called Easy Peasy Finance. It's also got a website with financial literacy resources. And we are going to have a conversation with him today. Now, are your money habits written in the stars? Do you think if you are a fan of astrology, your sign might mean that things are destined in terms of how you manage your money? Hannah Horvath from Easy Money is here to talk about what your horoscope means about your spending habits. Then, if you're not one for reading horoscopes, maybe a little bit of science can help you be better with your money. Behavioral science, that is. Wendy De La Rosa is co-founder of the Common Sense Lab at Duke University. She will be here with her tips and tricks on how you can use your mind to help manage your money. And we'll talk to Sean Cleary, chair of the Institute for Sustainable Finance, and Julie Kuzmic from Equifax Canada on how tackling your debt can sometimes hurt your credit score. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. I have had a lot of guests on this show from all over the world in every area of expertise. But I will say, without any question, my next guest is the youngest guest I have ever had on this program. His name is Rishi Vamdutt. He is someone who has created a YouTube channel a couple of years ago all about teaching kids about money. It is called Easy Peasy Finance. He joins me from New Jersey to talk about it. Hello, Rishi.
Hello. Hi, Bruce.
How old are you now and how old were you when you started this channel?
So right now I'm 11 years old. I'm in sixth grade. And when I started the channel, I was 8 and in third grade.
Oh my gosh. Quite amazing. I have an 11-year-old e-learning about 30 feet from me as I chat with you. So I know your demographic well. Where did the idea come from? I mean, lots of kids have this, you know, fantasy of having a YouTube channel, but mostly they're doing unboxing videos and, you know, streaming their Fortnite success. Where did Easy Peasy Finance come from?
Starting from when I was 6, I became interested in personal finance. So when I was 6, my dad had some books lying around and I started reading them and I became very interested in finance. So I asked my parents and they bought some more books for me. And from then, I just kept on reading more and more books and I became very interested in finance. And then 2 years later, when I was 8 years old, me and my parents decided that my interest in personal finance, it was a sustained interest and I'd continue to be interested in it. And we wanted to share my passion for finance with the world. And so that's how Easy Peasy Finance was born.
And what are some of the topics that you cover in your series?
So on Easy Peasy Finance, we cover many different topics of finance. We have over 160 videos that we've been publishing one per week for the last 3 years. And they cover topics like credit cards, banking, investing, the stock market, fixed income, retirement, taxes, things like that.
And they feature some pretty engaging personalities, Super Cooper and Wall Street Willie. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you got that right.
Tell me about these characters. And they're animated, by the way. So when people look at it, they'll recognize them. They're animated characters. And what do they get up to?
So Super Cooper, he's a cowboy and he asks questions. And then Wall Street Willie is a stockbroker and he answers them. So the way we came up with the two characters is because for a long time, I'd also been into doing accents and I was kind of good at doing a Southern accent. And so I decided that I should have two characters and I play both of them. And actually, most of the audience for Easy Peasy Finance doesn't actually know that it's me who plays both characters, which is interesting.
Wow. And how do you get into character? How did you develop these accents?
Well, for a long time, I've been doing these accents, so I don't really know exactly when I started, but I am interested in doing these accents as well. And so it kind of came naturally to me when we started Easy Peasy Finance to be able to do these different accents.
Now, you are walking the talk here. I know you create this content for your YouTube channel, but you also have demonstrated some very responsible behavior when it comes to your own money. I understand you canceled your own birthday parties. Is this true? What were you thinking? What kind of an 11-year-old does that?
Yeah. So starting from my 7th birthday, I told my parents that I didn't want to have any birthday parties because it would cost a lot of money. And so I decided to invest half the money and use the other half to buy things for myself instead of having a party and inviting all my friends.
Now, do you go to other people's birthday parties? I mean, kind of the circle of life here is you invite them to yours. And they invite you to theirs.
So before the pandemic, I did go to some birthday parties, but since the pandemic started, me and my family, we've been very cautious. So I haven't met my friends in over a year and I haven't gone to any parties.
Well, so great that you've got the YouTube channel to, keep you busy here. Your parents are involved. What is the role that they play?
So for creating our videos, first I do research and I come up with the first draft of the script. Then my parents, they review and fact check it to make sure it's accurate. And after that, I record it and I play both the characters. And then the other back end stuff like animation and publishing, that's done by my parents.
And what do you earn for an allowance? Do you get an allowance?
So yeah, I do get an allowance and my allowance is $1 for how old I am for every year, every week. So right now I'm 11 and I get $11 a week in allowance, which I then invest.
Now did you say you invest the whole sum of $11?
Yeah, I invest my entire allowance.
And what are you investing it in these days? Are you, playing around with derivatives and short selling Bitcoin?
Well, I believe in long-term investing and buy and hold investing. So right now, all my investments are for my retirement. So I like investing in index funds because they're diversified and they're especially also really good for people who are just starting to invest. And so I invest all my money in an S&P 500 index fund.
You can imagine it's a little hard for me to wrap my mind around the statement, I am investing for my retirement, when I am talking to someone who has not yet begun their career. How can you start saving for your retirement when you haven't even started working yet?
So in our videos, we cover this topic about compound interest. And from my research for those videos and everything, and before that too, like I learned that if you start investing at an early age, you'll get exponentially higher returns and you can earn a lot of money by the time you're ready to actually use the money in retirement. And so I want to start investing as early as possible so that I can maximize the returns. And that's why I started investing when I was 7.
Wow, that's amazing. When I tell my story, usually I'm the youngest investor in the room, but I opened my retirement savings account when I was 14, which compared to you makes me sound like a grandpa, given that you started well earlier than me. What about fun? What about adventures? What about backpacking around Europe and blowing $200 on a ridiculously overpriced pair of sneakers? Isn't life meant to be lived, Rishi?
So for those things on our channel, we do talk about how I think we've talked about how you shouldn't just invest all their money and how if you get a raise or anything like that or surprise money, you shouldn't just invest everything because like you said, you should enjoy life and you shouldn't just save for the future. You should also enjoy the present. And so we do talk about these things, but we say that you should at least save a good portion of the money. And for me, especially like for me personally, I don't really buy very expensive products like sneakers or anything, But at least before the pandemic, me and my parents, we've been traveling a lot together. So we've gone to different places. We've gone to South America and Antarctica, the Amazon rainforest, a lot of cities in Europe, and we've had a lot of fun traveling.
All right. I'm going to ask you an annoying grown-up question that my daughter always hates, and that is, where do you want to be in 10 years? What do you want to be doing in 10 or 20 years, maybe career-wise, but lifestyle-wise? What are some things that you want when you're twice as old as you are today?
So in those 10, 11 years or so, I hope to still be doing Easy Peasy Finance even after all that time. And by then, hopefully Easy Peasy Finance would have grown and would be able to reach a lot more people and help educate even more kids about personal finance. And also by that time, hopefully my parents could be working full time on Easy Peasy Finance so we could create even more free videos and resources.
Amazing. You are an inspiration. Congrats on what you have accomplished so far. And I'm going to be following you and checking in. We will have to have another conversation down the road when your voice changes and you have to introduce a new character to complement Super Cooper and Wall Street Willie. Rishi, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Rishi Vamdat is the creator, the voice, the author behind Easy Peasy Finance. You got to check out these videos on YouTube. They're quite amazing. And he is quite amazing.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Saving money is easier said than done. It takes more than just knowledge and effort and perseverance. Oftentimes, it takes managing our behavior in an environment awash in temptation and distraction. Wendy De La Rosa is an incoming professor at Wharton. She's a behavioral scientist and co-founder of the Common Sense Lab. She joins me now to talk about how we can use behavioral science to make better financial decisions. Hello there.
Hello there, Bruce.
Your topics read like articles in Cosmo magazine. Two examples: a simple two-step plan for saving more money, 10 steps to boost your financial health in a day. How did you go from being like a Stanford PhD to the creator of listicles?
You know, that is the best question that I've ever received.
I think it may well be.
The answer is I try to research everyday people and how everyday people make financial decisions. And the reality is that we're all busy, right? We don't have time to really dive into the complexities of compound interest and how that's going to play out over the next 50 years, which is, you know, essentially what I study. But what we can do is focus on size bite pieces of information that we can do today, right? In the middle of being parents and busy workers and having a full life to live, we can't afford to spend our whole lives thinking about our financial selves. So let me just break it down into the most critical pieces. And that's right. What I try to do.
And I hope you also do relationship advice and nutritional advice and use your listicle ability for the power of good. I want to ask you about the Common Sense Lab and what its mission is. What are you trying to do there?
So what we're trying to do is help people make better financial decisions by using the principles of behavioral science. And so we partner with fintech companies, credit unions, state and local governments to create, but most importantly, test interventions that move the needle on savings, debt repayment, as well as just overall financial management. Because I think we all have these good intuitions, right? We all think, oh, yeah, if I could just do X or do Y, that will really improve someone's financial well-being. And a lot of the times our intuitions are wrong. And so we come to these partnerships through the lens of academic science and say, well, let's actually test it. Let's run randomized controlled trials and actually see what works, because that's what we need. We don't need the nth intervention based on someone's opinion. We need research-backed interventions.
You did some research in the nonprofit credit counseling space with GreenPath. My day job is as the CEO of a nonprofit credit counselor. What are some of the things that you have learned in that context? Because people who pick up the phone and call a nonprofit credit counselor, they're in a pretty tough situation before they pick up the phone.
Yes, yes. So we have done so much work in the debt repayment space. First, I would just say, we come to this trying to take away the shame. We don't talk about financial decisions. I'm much more likely to know about my friend's sexual escapades than about their financial life. There's sort of this like deep ingrained financial shame that we feel that we just want to take away. The reality is, every company is getting smarter, faster, and more efficient at getting you to spend with your money. And so it's a David versus Goliath fight. And sometimes David is going to fail, but that's not because David is inherently flawed. It's just because the system is set up to help for David to fail. And so that's sort of step one, right? Let's sort of take away the shame. Step two is let's focus on things that can actually help people pay back their debt in an efficient way. So here's an experiment we ran. In one condition, we told people to pay back their credit card debt. And we said, hey, if you pay extra, you can save money on interest and pay down your debt faster. In another condition, we said, would you like to round up your payment to the nearest $100? If you pay this extra money, you'll save money on interest and pay down your debt faster. Well, guess what? Like, we love round numbers, right? Many of us have played this game at the gas pump where we try to hit exactly $20 or $30 or whatever it is.
Every time.
Right?
Always.
We can, and it makes sense because in our brains, it's much, much easier for us to understand $30 than it is to understand $28.48, right? And so guess what? People were much more likely to opt in to round up their payment every single time they made a mortgage payment or a debt repayment plan. And so they were able to save on average $8,000 on interest over the course of that week.
Wow. Wow. Now, here's another wow for me, because I've been covering budgeting for decades. You advocate for a frequency budget for eating out versus a dollar budget for eating out. What does that mean? And why is it more effective for many people to approach it that way?
The first thing I would say is when people sit down and create a budget, it can be overwhelming because many of the budget items, like your rent, like your car payment, there are fixed expenses. There's really nothing you can do about those except have a hard conversation and decide, I need to move to a cheaper place or I need to get a cheaper car, right? Those are one-time decisions. But most of the decisions that we should budget on an ongoing basis are sort of these regular occurring expenditures like eating out, shopping. These are the things that people really need to control. But if I were to ask you, Bruce, how much have you spent on eating out over the past week? Can you give me a good answer to that?
Well, it's a pandemic, so I can. Zero. It's zero. But, you know, I'm having cereal for dinner these days. Kidding. It's a harder number.
Right. And good for you for being a good citizen and not eating out during a global pandemic. We need more of that. But for people, it's very hard to remember that yesterday it had $8.50, a day before $16.27, and add that up. We're not human abacuses. What is really easy for us to remember is whether or not I ate out yesterday. And so I advocate for a frequency budget. Tell yourself, look, this week I can only eat out 3 times a week. And every time I eat out, I'm not going to spend more than $20. Now, all of a sudden, you have simplified your world. You have three chances. Okay, great. I know that I ate out yesterday and the day before. It's easier to remember. And because it's easier to remember, it will be easier for you to follow through on that intention.
What does the science say about the differences between high income earners and low income earners? Because obviously, if you make buckets of money, there are things you just don't have to deal with. If you make very little money, it can be much more difficult to just navigate the everyday hurdles in front of you. What does the science say about how our minds work based on that context?
Yeah. So the best research on this comes from Anusha, and he's found, and it's very easy to understand this, if you are constantly worried about your financial situation, whether or not you're going to be able to make your mortgage payment, how are you going to pay your credit card bills, you start to ruminate on your financial situation in a way that sort of takes up a vast space of your brain, like a vast majority of your brain space. And so when you're confronted with a task in front of you, it's much harder for you to concentrate. It's much harder for you to solve problems. It's much harder for you to actually go through life because you're only giving it, for lack of a better word, half a brain's attention. Because this financial constraint, your financial situation, is constantly in your brain.
We live through our phones these days. There is almost no communication, no planning, no action that occurs outside of that little device, that 2x4-inch device that we hold in our hands. If you had someone who was dealing with a troubling amount of debt and they said, "Wendy, here's my phone. You can do whatever you want to my phone such that my actions are consistent with my goals." What are some of the things you would do on that person's phone? I bet one of them would be to delete all of the delivery apps, but what else would you do? Because that is within our circle of control, what we have on our phone, what it has access to. What else would you do? What are the hacks?
Yeah. So here are a couple other things. You cannot spend on what you cannot see. And so the first thing is that everybody should install an ad blocker, right? Just think about your online life. You clicked on a pair of shoes or in a bag or on a furniture, and then it follows you throughout the internet. It's sort of like an online stalker. You see this image over and over again because of, you know, how online advertisers work. Install an ad blocker. You cannot spend on what you cannot see. On top of that, let's unenroll from all of the retail shopping lists that typically come into your inbox. Again, these sales are sort of set up to help entice you to come into the store with the hopes that you spend more on other things. So let's just completely change your environment. That's on the spending side of the house. Mm. On the debt repayment side of the house, we've talked about rounding up the payments, but hey, here's another trick. There are apps out there that can help increase the frequency in which you pay your debt. So instead of paying your monthly credit card bill once a month, the goal would be if you get paid twice a week, if you get paid bi-monthly, let's pay your credit card bi-monthly. If you get paid weekly, let's pay your credit card weekly. Why? Well, it turns out that the more frequently you pay your credit card debt, for example, the more money you save on interest. But also because of the calendar hack, if you pay $100 a month at the end of the year, you're just going to pay $1,200. But if you pay bi-monthly, at the end of the year, you're going to end up paying $1,300. So just by changing that environment, how often you're paying your debt, not by increasing your monthly amount, you are going to save money.
Genius. Genius. Wendy, thank you so much for your ideas and for your passion on this. I mean, it really is going to make a big difference for people over time. Thank you.
I'm just hopeful that we can bring as many people like you, Bruce, into the conversation to help the everyday person.
Yeah. Yeah. 100% agree. Wendy De La Rosa, an incoming professor at Wharton. She is a behavioral scientist and co-founder of the Common Sense Lab. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, unraveling the paradox of debt and your credit score. Some practices that are good for one are not good for the other. Julie Kuzmic from Equifax Canada will be here. And later, this is a fun one, what your horoscope says about how you manage your money. Anna Horvath from Easy Money will be our guest. To stay up to date with all things Moolala, our newsletter is free. You can get it at moolala.ca. It brings together all the fun stuff I do on CBC Radio and CityLine and BNN Bloomberg. Comes once a month, and I'm never going to do anything with your email address.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. In a fit of frustration over your debt, you might be tempted to call up all your credit card companies and cancel everything. Don't do that. Don't do that. Some actions you might think are good for your debt could actually be bad for your credit score. Julie Kuzmic is the Director of Consumer Advocacy for Equifax Canada, and she joins me now to talk about some of these ideas and what you could do instead. Julie, hello there.
Hello.
Why, first of all, why does the credit score matter? Because we're going to talk about things that some would argue, well, that's actually a better way to, you know, rein in your debt. But if they negatively affect your credit score, that's not good for you. Why does the credit score matter?
The credit score is actually intended to be a prediction of the likelihood that people will pay their bills on time. Mm. When you boil it down, that's the whole point of a credit score. And a quick reminder, there are actually multiple credit scores out there. So when we talk about our credit score, we should actually be saying scores, because anybody who has looked up their credit scores from multiple places can probably relate that the numbers aren't always the same. So why does a credit score matter? Credit scores are often used as one of the measures that a lender or another organization, like even a landlord or a potential new employer, uses as part of a decision-making process on how risky we as an individual might be as an applicant. So whether you're applying for a new credit card or you're maybe looking for a new apartment and your landlord wants to take a look at your credit history and take a look at a credit score, or as I said, even a prospective employer does that sometimes.
It matters. It matters. Okay. So I mentioned this canceling all your credit cards idea, which can be, I mean, you could argue it's good for your debt in that you can't rack up more charges. You'll just use cash. It'll be great. But that's not good for your score for a couple reasons. Why is that?
Well, the credit scores are calculated based on the information that is in your credit file or your credit report, which is what gets reported to the major credit bureaus in Canada on a monthly basis by the different lenders and creditors out there. So if you don't use credit, even the basic use of a credit card on and off, then you're not going to have updated information filling up your credit file. Mm. And ultimately, you're not going to end up being able to get a credit score calculated.
Mm. So never using them is a problem. But I can also imagine it's problematic if you had credit cards, some with a pretty solid credit history, like you've had it for 10 or 15 years, you cancel those cards, you lose that credit history, which can put some weight on your score.
Yeah. Now this one, we hear a lot of questions around. Sometimes people want to do a wallet slim down exercise and get rid of some of those old cards that have been hanging around for years. So it can be an issue if you're getting rid of the, let's say, the credit card that you've had the longest.
Yeah.
What you're ultimately doing is reducing the average age of the credit accounts that you have on your credit file. And the reason that can affect your credit score calculations is that there is a statistical correlation between how long credit accounts have been open and people having positive payment histories or making payments on time. Now, this is one of literally hundreds of factors that go into the credit score calculations. So I don't want someone listening to this to think, oh my gosh, I can never close a credit account again. Sometimes you don't have a choice. Sometimes credit card companies decide to exit their Canadian business, as some of the big ones have done recently. I've had that happen to me where a credit card I had just decided, oh, we're not going to operate in Canada anymore. And of course, when I got that note in the mail, my first response was, but my credit score.
Oh, good. I'm glad even you sings that song. That's good.
Yes. However, it can be a very small component in the overall score calculation. Right. The amount of an impact that it has is going to vary from person to person, depending on the other information that is in their credit file at the time the score is calculated.
Well, there's one last little element that I want to flag here is around utilization. So say you had three cards and the total credit available was 10 grand in a fit of, I don't know what, you cancel two of those three, but don't pay down your debt. Isn't that going to increase the utilization, which could have a negative effect on your score?
It certainly can. So quick reminder about what we're talking about when we talk about utilization. That is the percentage or the amount of your credit limit that you're currently using. So let's say you've got a credit card with a $10,000 limit. If you have a $5,000 balance, you're at a 50% utilization. And people often wonder, what matters more? The utilization across all cards? So if you add it all up or on each card individually. And the answer to that can vary across credit score versions. So again, there isn't a specific rule of thumb about targets other than keeping utilization low if you can. So keeping balances low, that's always better from a credit score calculation perspective. But I want to remind people, I know when you hear these details and it can feel very frustrating, well, how am I ever going to get a good credit score? Or if I can't get these specific answers on exactly what to do. When you take a step back and remember, the point of a credit score is to predict whether or not you will pay your bills on time. The most important thing to do is pay your bills on time.
Wow. It's pretty simple. Okay. I want to move on to opening up new cards, because what some people do to get a handle on their debt is they take those promotional low rates and they move their money around. A lot of people, it's like a video game, which can be good for debt in that your interest amount can be lower. Not so good because all those inquiries and new applications can be a negative for your score.
Yes. So I guess it depends on whether the video game ends up being whack-a-mole in the end, where you just can't get a handle on that debt. That's probably not ideal. One of the factors in credit score calculations is opening new credit recently. And the way that that is represented on a credit file is that there are hard inquiries that get recorded on your credit file when you are applying for new credit. And again, the impact of how many recent hard inquiries and how much of an impact it's going to have at all, because there are some people who could apply for a few new accounts within a short period of time and not see any impact on their scores at all. All of that depends on the other information in your credit file at the time the score is calculated. So rather than fixating on a particular score number that you're seeing somewhere, because many people are tracking their credit scores in one place or more than one place, it's really important to make sure the information on your credit file is accurate, because that's what all the different scores are calculated on.
There are some people who only want one source of credit. They're like, I'm just going to have one credit card. That is it. And they're missing an opportunity, as I understand it, to improve their score if they had some diversity, right? If they had a line of credit or a second card or something about that. Can you talk about that? Because that's another element where people are so rigorous about not racking up more debt, but it may be a negative to their score.
Yeah, so there are a few elements there. One is that the more accounts that somebody has on their credit file, the more solid and rich a credit history, then the easier it can be to predict a credit score. So if you only have one account to go on and you have, say, one missed payment on that account, that might affect that person more than someone who's got a few different accounts and misses one payment on one account. So you may be on a little more solid ground when you've got a little more of a diverse credit history behind you. And the other factor there is that a mix of credit products, so combination of, say, revolving credit accounts like a credit card or a line of credit, and potentially installment loans like a more of a standard bank loan, a car loan, a mortgage, that type of thing. There is a statistical correlation again between people having a little more of a diverse credit history in terms of types of accounts and people paying bills on time. And so that's why that is one of the factors that goes into the score calculation. But again, it's not nearly as critical as the paying your bills on time piece.
Fascinating stuff. Julie, thank you for joining us for all that context. We appreciate it.
It's always so fun to talk to you, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Julie Kuzmic, the Director of Consumer Advocacy for Equifax Canada. The focus of our conversation was good for debt, maybe bad for score. I hope you learned something about how those scores are calculated and why they're so important.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, we'll talk to Sean Cleary from the Institute for Sustainable Finance at Queen's University about its latest report. But first, we're going to look to the stars for some money guidance with Hannah Horvath from Easy Money. She looks at money horoscopes. Yeah, it's a thing. If you'd like to listen to some more Moolala, you've got a bunch of choices. There's our website, moolala.ca. You can search by topic. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms out there, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, wherever it is. You can download the full show. You can also review the podcast. You can subscribe to the next podcast, and then it will just arrive right away on your device.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Do you need a little help with your money management? Well, maybe you just need to look to the stars. Look to the stars for some guidance. If you believe in astrology, and I shouldn't minimize it, many people do, your sign might have something to do with how well you handle your money. Hannah Horvath is Deputy Managing Editor of Easy Money, and she is here to tell us about money horoscopes and what we might be able to learn from them. For fun or for fact, I don't know. Hannah's in the East Village of Manhattan. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Good to chat with you.
Good to chat with you again, too. I know nothing about astrological signs other than the fact that I am a Leo and Leos are the best, which I think Leos always say, because that's probably in the sign. What was your mindset going into this story? Were you like fully in with both feet? Were you skeptical?
Yeah. So I was interested in it for a little bit. You know, I knew my sign for context. Everyone, I'm a Scorpio. Do with that information what you will. I would read my horoscope occasionally. And, you know, as a money journalist, I constantly want to think about how money connects to everything in our lives. So I wanted to kind of explore how your zodiac sign, how astrology, you know, intersects with money. And if, you know, your sign determines, you know, how you manage money.
There has been a tremendous increase in astrology over the last 12 months. I mean, there's been a tremendous increase in anything that doesn't require us to leave our house. So I think, you know, astrology, I guess it's not all that surprising. But to what do you attribute this increased interest in this area of study?
Yeah, it's definitely twofold. One, definitely people are spending more time at home. They're online more. They want to feel more connected to each other. So they're kind of downloading those apps. I'm sure you've heard about CoStar, apps like that, you know, trying to kind of make meaning of everything. And then, you know, the other probably reason is because people are probably feeling a little uncertain. These past 12 months have been nothing short of unexpected. So they're trying to kind of maybe create meaning in all this, try to find some solid ground. And astrology has kind of served that purpose for a lot of people, especially in lockdown.
Leos, here's what it says for me. Leos sometimes spend impulsively, but are known to also set bold, ambitious money goals and will stick with their plan until they accomplish it. I don't know. I'm actually don't think I really spend impulsively, but that's maybe because of what I do for a living. How would you characterize the insights that are connected to each of the astrological signs? How much wiggle room is there in those, I don't know, predictions or summaries?
Yeah. So this is my opinion. You know, astrology, according to some studies, isn't 100% based in science. I would definitely take anything you read about your horoscope, especially when it comes to money, with a grain of salt. But I think it can help you kind of understand your financial behavior, or at least get you thinking about money. You know, I really feel like the big obstacle for people when trying to, you know, figure out their finances is just their inability to address it. You know, they don't check their bank account. They don't talk about money. So I think, you know, in my book, if someone's reading about their horoscope, they're reading about how they approach their finances, and that gets them to start thinking more about money, that's all good in my book. Let me give you an example. Actually, I actually am a Scorpio, like I said, and they are known for impulsive spending as well. And, you know, that doesn't mean I'm necessarily doomed to make these kind of impulsive decisions for the rest of my life. But, you know, in writing this, it did kind of have me thinking, you know, what was the last impulse purchase I made? You know, how can I be better about avoiding these types of temptations in the future? So it kind of got those wheels, turning in my head, and, you know, had me maybe making better money decisions in the future.
So Taurus is another sign. My mom's a Taurus. It says that she struggles with budgeting. I don't know if that's true. She had five children. She didn't have much choice other than to budget the food accordingly, or we'd starve. How would you recommend people read these pronouncements? I mean, is there a risk here? Is there a downside?
Yeah, I definitely don't want people to read their horoscope and, you know, think of it as prescriptive. You know, for example, a Taurus, oh, I'm doomed to overspend for the rest of my life. There's no way for me to budget because I'm a Taurus. You know, I definitely don't think that's true, in my opinion. I think you should take everything you kind of read there with a grain of salt. But maybe this is an opportunity to think, you know, okay, you know, my sign says I'm an overspender. Well, how is my spending? You know, how is my budget? Is there places where I could maybe cut back a little bit? You know, am in quarantine, did I sign up for 100 subscription services and I maybe need to cut that down? That's all good in my book.
What did you learn about how the insights are gathered here? Like, was there some ancient script that these lessons are then just extrapolated from? I don't have any sense for the origins or really even the discipline in which these observations get made.
So I talked to a couple astrologers for this story, and to my understanding, they spend a lot of time, you know, just looking to the stars and, you know, looking to where the star patterns are, where the planets are aligned. And, you know, I think over the course of history, people have made a lot of trend lines and patterns about how behavior correlates to, planetary alignment. And that's how astrologers kind of create these horoscopes or create these predictions. But huge caveat, you know, is this 100% rooted in science? In fact, that's very much up for debate. But at least when I talk to astrologers, that kind of was their line of thinking.
One of the things that personal finance folks like you and I talk a lot about are relationships and how they can be helpful and harmful in helping people get a handle on their money. A lot of astrologers talk about that too, the intersection or the interplay between signs. What did you learn about that? Like, should a Leo be married to a Sagittarius? Like, I don't know. What's the killer combination for health and wealth?
They didn't name any like star pairings, but I will say, you know, obviously in the zodiac signs and in astrology, there are certain signs that are supposed to be better together. Again, I don't know if that's necessarily true, but I will say, you know, being transparent is always huge. And I think that's huge with any, you know, relationship. And I think two signs that are quote unquote not supposed to be compatible, they can absolutely be compatible. It just is all about, you know, your communication and how you approach your relationship, I guess.
This is all such fantastic stuff. Hannah, thank you for joining us today to talk about it.
Yeah, Bruce, it's a pleasure as always.
Hannah Horvath, Deputy Managing Editor at Easy Money. And she did this great piece on your money horoscope. Look it up, read it, and see if it applies to you. Stay with us. Coming up next, we'll go a little more down the science path. We're going to talk to the chair of the Institute for Sustainable Finance. Queen's University Smith School of Business has this new institute and some great research about how Canadian companies are doing on tracking things like emissions. Now, we're hanging out on the radio. I also do a lot of television. And if you want to check out some of those segments, I'm also the money columnist for a show called Cityline. Those segments are at cityline.tv. Search for me. And I bet they cover astrological signs too on Cityline. It's probably even more interesting than me.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Green bin, check. Electric vehicle, check. Carbon offsets, check. But what can be done in the world of finance to help this shift towards a lower carbon world? The Institute for Sustainable Finance at the Smith School of Business at Queen's University has a number of ideas, many ideas, in fact. It recently released a report that assessed Canadian publicly traded corporations. Sean Clear is the co-author of the report and chair of the Institute for Sustainable Finance. He joins us now to talk about it. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Thank you for having me today.
It's my pleasure. Now, disclosure here, I'm on the advisory board for the Smith School of Business, which is how I know about the work of the Institute. In a sentence or two, how would you describe what it does, what its mission is?
The ISF is a collaborative hub located at Queen's University Smith School of Business, as you said. Launched in the fall of 2019, and our mission is to align mainstream financial markets with Canada's transition to a prosperous, sustainable economy. Mm-hmm. And if I just might add, it does so based on four pillars: research and education, and also collaboration and outreach. So all of our activities fall in at least one or two of those categories.
5 years ago, I interviewed a series of small and mid-cap energy CEOs for the CBC, and four out of five would not acknowledge the human contribution to climate change. Four out of five. What would you say is the current mindset around sustainable finance? It feels like things have moved a tremendous amount in the last 5 years.
Certainly in the last 5 years, we begun setting up the Institute about 3 years ago and launched a year and a half ago. And it seems like every month activity and initiatives and actions are accelerating. So it's amazing how far we've come in terms of the discussions that I had 2 years ago and a year ago and today.
I want to hear some examples of what sustainable finance looks like, because it is such a broad area, right? There's personal finance, there's corporate finance, there's government finance. What are some examples of things that that organizations are doing that would be consistent with these principles?
Yeah, so that's sustainable finance, what it looks like, it's as simple as incentives to purchase electric cars or to make your homes more energy efficient. And it's much more complex in terms of issuing green or transition bonds that are designed to finance activities to reduce a company or municipalities, or in the case of Canada, which has announced at the federal level to issue green bonds to finance activities to make the make a green contribution to the environment.
Mm. You published this report looking at emissions and emissions reporting specifically by TSX-listed companies. Why is that an important measure? Why did you look at that measure in particular?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it comes from, you know, what gets measured gets gets addressed. Mm-hmm. And one of, you know, if we have a target of reducing our emissions in Canada, a moving target apparently over the last week, that's gone from 30% by 2030 to 36% on Monday and then to 45% on Tuesday. Mm. So I think that if you think of that at the company level, they're getting pressure to establish targets to report on their emissions by the financial institutions and by other stakeholders in society as a whole. So my co-author Andrew Hakes and I, who's a research associate at the Institute, we said, well, you know, we know we're improving. We know a lot of firms are disclosing, but we really don't know where we are in terms of how many and how well we sit compared to others.
Well, talk a little bit about the findings. I mean, I think the headline is Canada is what, better than Japan, but worse than Europe. What would you say about how we stack up globally?
Yeah, that's that was interesting to us, too. It was like one of the startup questions. We're about on par with the U.S. in terms of disclosures ahead of Japan. About two-thirds of the firms, and I should note that these are the firms in the TSX index or the S&P TSX Composite Index. So that includes 222 of the largest publicly listed companies in Canada, and 150 of them disclose GHG emissions data, and that means 72 of them do not. So that's about on par with the U.S., but it's below the European Union, where there's about 79%, in the U.K., where essentially they all report such emissions.
There is a good breadth of companies listed on the TSX. It makes perfect sense in my mind that energy companies would have a mechanism for that and be like, okay, we know how to think about that. How do you encourage companies who are in the business of banking or in the business of software where it's less obvious what their emissions would be?
Yeah, and we see a good, you know, in terms of the disclosures, we see a good cross-section on the emissions. And I think you rightly point out that a lot of firms in the high-emitting industries are actually those disclosing, and it's because they have pressures to disclose, and also because it's important for their own business planning, right, to have this measure that they can stack up against as they go forward. So it's, you know, the technology is improving rapidly, and these are things that can be done and are being done by the majority of firms.
What's the call to action for investors, both institutional and retail? Is it, you know, ensuring that some of your asset allocation includes socially responsible investing? Is it voting at shareholder meetings? What would make a difference for investors?
Well, there's a number of different approaches to it, Bruce. And I think one of the things, and to turn back to the report, while we found that we were, you know, doing okay, not as good as we would like on disclosures, when it came to reduction targets setting, and we're seeing these announcements in the news, you know, on a weekly basis, that's where Canada is quite far behind both the US and EU, with just over 25% of the firms in the index disclosing targets. And these are important considerations for the firms themselves for internal planning purposes, but also for their suppliers of capital that are demanding this information. They want to know what their plan is for a transition. And you know, some firms are providing that basic information, and a lot are not. Because, for example, I said 27% in Canada, 53% in the U.S. S&P 500 index, and again, two-thirds in the U.K. So we that's an area where probably even more so behind some of our global competitors. And I was actually watching a session this morning, and Mark Carney, of course, the Canadian champion in the space, was talking about that these are things that capital providers are looking for. They're looking for setting targets, having reasonable plans to achieve them, and you will be measured against that. And that was the message, and kind of that was kind of a starting point for our report, if you will.
Yeah.
For part of our report. Yeah.
What gets measured gets managed, right?
Exactly.
The way that it works. Sean, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Bruce. Thanks for all your help.
You're welcome. Sean Cleary, the chair of the Institute for Sustainable Finance at the Smith School of Business at Queen's University. A really interesting read on this report. I mean, I think it's interesting. You may look at it as like emission data. Why is that interesting? I think it's really interesting because it's Canadian companies either stepping up to the challenge and getting super clear on their business practices, and other Canadian companies who are choosing to, for now anyway, hold their heads in the sand. That is it for our show today. Thank you so much to our sponsor, Credit Canada, this country's first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, the easiest way to do that is to subscribe to our newsletter. Moolala.ca is where you'll find that. You will find out things every month about this radio show, CBC, my column there, CityLine, BNN Bloomberg, blah, blah, blah. Even more helpful, you could go and subscribe to the podcast. And while you're there, on whichever platform you're subscribing to it on, leave us a review. That'd be great. If you have comments, if you have questions, if you have ideas, feedback, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. On social media, at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us today. Take care.